That's Reverend Charles Bronson speaking at the Intercommunal Day of Solidarity, March 5th, 1971. That day included Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, and many others. My name is Sylvester Rivers, and we're going to continue this program taking a look at Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, and the Black Panther Party.
At the hospital ceiling came in over the operating table. Let the doctor have a rusty scalpel in his hand. Oh, Lordy. Oh, Lord. And if that's not bad enough for the governor, let him be stranded in the Sahara Desert. 10,000 miles.
Hey, we're talking to Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, residing in Philadelphia right now. We're going to start out talking now maybe about some of the things that you're working on right now, the memoirs. You're working on some memoirs right now?
Well, it's called Bobby Seale Memoirs. It's subtitled The Rise and Decline of the Black Panther Party as one theme. It's called Seize the Time, Seize the Rage for a film script concept that I'm trying to work with, and also trying to be part of the development of that film script. This is really my life story, but it's also the story of the Black Panther Party, the rise and decline of the Black Panther Party. It encompasses the profound contribution that Huey P. Newton made. It also encompasses Huey's demise. When Huey really started demising, way before he was killed recently here in 1989. It's a very, very broad story. It encompasses the many developments of all the Black Panther Party chapters, the individuals, the people, the characters. It documents and relates to a lot of the old COINTELPRO FBI operations that was against the Black Panther Party based on much of my Freedom of Information Act records. And I hope to write it in such a way that while it may be a lot of essay, pro and con analysis, of how and why the Black Panther Party developed. On the other end, I will include, of course, probably over 50 or 60% of the work will be written probably, one of the styles I love was Richard Wright. Richard Wright, particularly with Black Boy, that particular book he wrote. Richard Wright had the great ability to integrate fiction techniques into a non-fiction work. Well, when I wrote A Lonely Rage, my autobiography, I mean, it did not deal extensively with the decline of the Black Panther Party, and I will deal with it here in this particular book. And I tell a lot of stories, you know what I mean? I love to tell the stories. I love the dialogue. I love the interaction relationship so people can feel, understand, and see what I was experiencing and what was developing around me, particularly with the rise and decline of the Black Panther Party. I mean, where was this rage of mine? I mean, it was like manifested really in a vicious beating my father gave me in San Antonio, Texas when I was 7 years of age. And my mother used to be angry at my father for whipping me that time because she knew he had whipped me for nothing, and I learned and understood that. So as a lot of things developed, how I came about my nigger Tarzan years. People don't know what I was called nigger Tarzan at age 16 and 17. Nigger Tarzan was a nickname that me and my friend Steve Brumfield had developed at age 16 and 17 because we decided we didn't want to run with the hooligan type gangs in the community, and we began to identify really at that time, age 16, 17, we knew nothing of Black history, of course. We identified with Native Americans, particularly what people call the Sioux Indians. We later found out after a year later that the word Sioux was a word, there was a French word, it meant cutthroat, and we found the real name of what they call or refer to Native Americans as Sioux. They're called the Lakota Nation, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And we identified with Sitting Bull, you know, kicking Custer's butt, you know what I mean? But we were not really political. We were just young men who were really, health outdoor types. That's part of my history too.
So you were raised in San Antonio?
No. I was born in Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas. Uh-huh.
San Antonio, my family left there when I was 8.5 years of age. It was wartime, late 1945. And my father left prior to us, and then we went to California. I was literally raised from 8.5, almost 9 years of age. I was raised in Berkeley, California, and then Oakland, California, you see, from that age, you see. So my real whole growing, developing life from 9 years of age on was Oakland and Berkeley. And then later, of course, I was in the United States Air Force. People don't know that I was actually kicked out of the United States Air Force after 3 years, 11 months, and 11 days of a four-year enlisted tour to the United States Air Force because I had a conflict with a racist colonel. And then I still didn't have any politics. It was just that racism creeps in your life. And next thing you know, you're fighting and battling to survive. Mm-hmm. It was not until later, you know, in my lifetime that that I'll be writing in these books about. I was in Merritt College as an engineering design major. I'd been there for a year and a half. And come spring of 1962, I walked out of the main entrance of the building. You know, I was all dressed up in my little Ivy League tie and stuff with a plastic see-through carrying case for my drafting board and stuff like that. But I walked across the street and noticed a street corner rally going on with about 100 students standing around, you know what I mean? And somebody was speaking, you know, and somebody was saying, the Afro-American Association has come here to tell it like it is. And they got to telling and talking about African countries and African nations, because I knew no history up to this point, no real African-American people's history. I just honestly didn't know, you know. And of course, here what we got is a situation that when he says that we are not Negroes, we are not colored, white folks done brainwashed y'all and told y'all y'all was something that you ain't, you know what I mean? Well, automatically, I'm thinking and remembering when I was 16 or 17, earlier in life, that the Lakota Nation had been misnamed. They were called cutthroats. The word Sioux is a French word that meant cutthroat, right? So I intently listened to these guys, and they got to talking about Jomo Kenyatta and Richard Wright and Kwame Nkrumah. I didn't know who these people were, you know what I mean? But I went and got a book by Jomo Kenyatta, Facing Mount Kenya, and read that book and found out that Tarzan did not run Africa. So really, I mean, what you got here is a young man. Well, really, I'm 5 years older than Huey, but Huey was part of the guys standing in the back of Donald Warden saying, tell it, brothers, tell it like it is, run it down and stuff like that. It's about five or six guys. Well, one of those guys was Steve Brumfield's brother. Now, at this time in 1962, Steve Brumfield is dead. You know, I haven't seen Steve Brumfield since I was 18. Here I am at a point in life, I guess I'm 24 years old, turning to be 25 in 1962. So I meet this, so Steve Brumfield introduces me to all these other guys, and one of these guys is Huey P. Newton. And he's very articulate. So I says, you guys are saying Afro and not Negro. And Huey, part of the conversation of young intellectuals then, says, yeah, that's correct. Because African-American, Huey says, is a more correct social scientific reference to us rather than Negro. And as Kenny Freeman, he says, and as Donald Warden has said earlier, there's no such place as Negro land. And this was really an early period, spring 1962, across the street from Merritt College. I lived a half a block from Merritt College at the time. But, you know, a lot of students around, but 100 or so standing around listening to this rally. And this is where I became interested. So after I began to read a lot, after that semester, I dropped my engineering design major and rushed over into the political social sciences, particularly studying African-American history, all aspects and all phases of it, the complete continent of Africa. I wound up with a big map of all the old ethnic, or what they used to call tribal, but ethnic groups that existed throughout the total continent of Africa. I mean, I really began to study. I got down to a point after a year or so, I knew all the basic mental resources in the bowels of the earth, you know what I mean? So by the time 1964, 63, 64, and Toshombe and others, you know, are murdering and killing and bringing South African mercenaries into the Congo after Lumumba is murdered and others, you know, I mean, really, I'm acutely aware that the Katanga, southern province, southern Katanga province, of Congo Brazzaville, now Zaire, was producing 40% of the world's copper ore. And it was about that economic factor of why Africa and black people and others were being exploited, raped, put in slavery historically, etc. So that world realization really concretized for me in a matter of a couple of years, plus the history of African-American peoples, the history of African peoples, you know, down to a point of understanding why our idiomatic expressions came out as they did. Then, I mean, you have to remember back in 63, 64, I wrote a paper on Black English, why we say this, that, dim, yo, mo, and fo, why we pronounce those words that way, rather than saying this, that, dim, your, more, and for. I found out, you know, from research, and Dr. Lorenzo Dow Turner, who did some of the most profound research on linguistics and language in Africa and surviving Africanisms in Black American language, I found out that there were no T-H-E-R-A-R rolling R sounds in the West African languages. This is about late 1963. I mean, you have to imagine the amount of materials I have digested in various street corner rallies and various groups and various meetings. You know, I really got off into knowing what our liberation struggle was about back in those days, you see. So I'm running in and out, and I see Huey here and there. One time I took Huey in a anthropology class and said, Huey, I want you to come to the class with me, man, because this anthropology instructor, she keeps using the word negroid and mongoloid, and then she uses a superficial, very pretty, supposedly superior sounding Caucasian when she refers to white folks, you know. I says, and we got to get her to stop using this word negroid, because it talks negro and there's no such thing, you know, as you said a year and a half ago, as negro land. So Huey and I got into the class one day, you know, and did all our research, et cetera, et cetera. And so I interrupt the class and I says, you consistently use negroid. I don't think you should be using negroid. Then Huey came up and says, a more correct term would be Africanoid. I says, right, negroid, Africanoid. I said, that's the more correct reference, the more correct scientific social references. And she was arguing back and forth with him, and I demanded that she consistently stop using negroid. I said, fine. I said, we're going to equalize this terminology. I says, right, as Huey P. Newton said, Africanoid. I says, and then mongoloid. I said, when we get to white folks, stop this Caucasian. We want you to say caucasoid, so we can equal. So these are the kind of things on campus. I mean, that kind of stuff, when we come out of the classroom, I mean, we'd have another crowd, Huey and I, standing around us, you know what I mean? So you have to imagine the atmosphere and our education. We were part of a young Black intelligentsia who was growing, who was developing a new polemic in opposition to white racism and all its entrenched notions of how Black folks have become brainwashed, and we were unbrainwashing ourselves. You know, I digested Blues People by Leroy Jones, you know, presently Amira Baraka's great work. You know, I digested Missing the Negro Past by Marvel J. Herskovitz, The African Slave Trade by Basil Davidson. I mean, you have to imagine, I digest 100 works and books, and I had subscriptions from all kinds of periodicals, Freedom Ways, The Liberator, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what was going on back then. This is what those first 4 years about, 1962, 63, 64, 65. And I hadn't seen Huey for almost a year, I guess, around this time, somewhere along there. And the next thing I know, Brother Malcolm X was murdered. You talking about somebody mad and angry. I had a one-man riot for two blocks. Matter of 20, 30 minutes. I mean, the other friends I was with then had to come down and get me because I broke three or four windows. I threw bricks at any big limousine-looking car with white folks in it because, as far as I was concerned, white folks had engineered the death of Malcolm X. You know what I mean?
Well, were you able to see him speak when he was living?
I saw him speak one time probably a year or so before that at McClyman's High School in West Oakland. I never got a chance to actually shake his hand. I stood about 15 feet from him in the lobby after the speaking when all the cameras and press were around him, you know? I later wrote, after he got out of the Nation of Islam, I wrote to the OAAU that he had created in New York to try to get some more information about it, because at that time I was thinking about going out to New York and joining the OAAU. But this was another time, another era, another period where I was just a young Black male who was really reaching for something that made more human sense, you think.
So now, after his death, he went on a rampage.
I went to find Huey. I couldn't find Huey. And I just kept telling Huey we got to start something. So it took me about a year to convince Huey that we had to start something. So I guess he was closely convinced, and by the time we created the Soul Students Advisory Council and got out of that organization, And Huey and I was really intent on it. I got him a job and everything with me over at the North Oakland Neighborhood Service Center. I already worked at the North Oakland Neighborhood Service Center for the Department of Human Resources, the city government involved in the war on poverty programs back then. And I was still going to Merritt College part-time by then. But I'm just saying that we finally decided, you know, the Watts riots had happened August 1965. Malcolm X was killed, May 19th, 1965. So many things had happened, you know. We were involved in history, involved in this, involved in that. I'd even done some black plays over in San Francisco, 65, 66, with Marvin Jackman, who wrote some of the plays, Flowers for the Trash Man, what have you, etc. We're just involved, along with the job, along with this, going to this kind of meeting, this kind of rally. Stokely came out, I think, to one point in early September 1966 and spoke. He was talking black power, black power, black power. So Huey and I, in the discussions and everything, deducted that power is the ability to define phenomena, then in turn make it act in a desired manner. And little did we know that nowadays, such a concept or such a definition of power is a somewhat of what we call a three-dimensional concept of power, you know. But we didn't know that. We didn't terminology, you know, categorize it such as then.
Explain that.
Power is the ability to define phenomena, then in turn make it act in a desired manner. Be that phenomena found in nature, or be that phenomena found in the political, economic, and social relationships between individuals, peoples, groups, ethnic groups, classes, what have you. How do you define that phenomenon? If you see a negative phenomenon that oppresses people, then you look at its political institutions, its economic institutions, its social institutions, and social relationships. If you deny that phenomenon, and if it's negative, it's oppressive, if it's racial, if it's vicious, if it's fascist in its nature, then how do you make it act in a desired manner? You know. So that's where we were coming from, you see. So when we got way before the Black Panther Party started, Huey Newton and I had gotten some signatures calling for a community police review board. Remember, we worked for the North Oakland Neighborhood Service Center. Well, that center had an advisory board of community people then. I guess some 30-odd people was on that advisory board for the North Oakland Neighborhood Service Center. And we had to report to them every 2 weeks, make reports. All the employees under the North Oakland had to come report, so we were employees too. And of course, they would have issues and problems other than just the center, you know, the war on poverty program. So the problem of vicious police brutality came up. And Huey and I suggested that we have a petition that should be signed by registered voters and people in the community, and that the North Oakland Neighborhood Service and then should submit it to the city council, the city government of Oakland, calling for a review board to deal with complaints of vicious police brutality rampant in our community. So in effect, it was Huey, I, Lil Bobby Hutt, and I had hired him there for the winter season, and a couple more youth. I was the supervisor of all of them. Huey was just like the social relationship liaison then, and his job, it was a part-time job with the community. So we went out and got these 5,000 signatures, brought them back to the, over a month or two period, and gave them to them, and they went down and got on the agenda of the city council, and they let them speak 3 minutes, and of course the city council ignored the people. In other words, here's a city council, a legislative, local city legislative framework, and the phenomena we're dealing with here is more racism, ignoring 40% population of black and another 10% population of Chicano and poor and low-income minority people in the community, ignoring their basic complaints. You see what I'm getting at? So the phenomena of the city council is that it's racist. Now, how do you make it act in a desired manner? So we decided that we're going to start a new organization. So one night, we sit down, Huey P. Newton and I, in the War on Poverty office. See, I had the keys there, and I live closest to the place, 3 blocks. Huey lived about 4 more blocks, but I'd been there longer. And the reason I had the keys was because when every worker goes out, they have to turn the burglar alarm on. If somebody break in it, then the burglar alarm people would call me, since I live close to the center and I'd have to go down there. Well, I actually owned a 9mm pistol, not for the purpose of starting the Black Panther Party, but I just owned one with a holster and stuff, and I would strap it to throw it over my arm, and whenever they burglar alarm people call, I'd go down there. Well, anyway, Hugh and I would just go in there. You know, we'd turn the burglar alarm off and go in there, and that's where we wrote the 10-point platform and program in a War on Poverty office where we worked. beginning about, I guess, October 10th or 12th or something. And 10 days later, we finished the 10-point platform and program of the Black Panther Party, flipped the coin to see who would be chairman. I won chairman, told Huey it was no use to him flipping, and you was automatically Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party, you know what I mean? So that's the way we created the Black Panther Party, you know, and then we decided we would function on point number 7, where we say we wanted an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people in our black community. Well, we knew, see, and we also had a big law library, a legal aid service to the community in that North Oakland neighborhood service center, and a law library upstairs, two gigantic rooms full of law books that Huey stayed in. Because even at this time, remember, Huey was still enrolled in law, night law school, a private night law school, San Francisco Law School, you see. So we researched the laws on guns, et cetera, the Constitution, any kind of constitutional amendments or any kind of Supreme Court rulings and stuff like that. We'd also found that all citizens, through that research Huey did, had a right to observe a police officer carrying out their duty as long as they stood a reasonable distance away. Now, what do we have here? You see what I'm getting at? We have a profound situation evolving. We're also measuring, right just before we're founding the Black Panther Party, the CAP group, Community Alert Patrol, that evolved following the Watts riots a year earlier in 1965. That group had begun to be attacked by the police. It was getting their heads beat, their tape recorders smashed up, their law books tore up, and that group was being drugged downtown and being locked up. Well, that was the reason Huey did the research anyway and found that there had been a California Supreme Court ruling that stated that all citizens had a right to observe a police officer carrying out their duty as long as they stood a reasonable distance away. And a reasonable distance in that particular ruling, as Huey used to say, was 8 to 10 feet. You see what I'm getting at?
Yes.
Now, on the other end of knowing all the gun laws, the fish and game code laws, and as long as the guns were not concealed, they were really not illegal. In other words, we were creating an organization. We were like a social evolutionary accident, but yet creating an organization and taking civil disobedience and putting it on the cutting edge. Why? Because, as Huey had said concerning the Black Panther, the nature of a Black Panther, the actual animal plant panther, is that if you push it into a corner, if it can't move left, if it can't move right, ha-ha, then that panther will come out of that corner to wipe out the aggressor that pushed it into a corner in the first place, that's oppressing in the first place. I says, right, Huey. I said, that's the same way black people are. He says, what do you mean? I says, look, Huey. I says, peaceful protesters are exercising the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States to peacefully redress their grievances. I said, that's written in the Constitution. I said, but these racists, the power structure, the George Wallace's, Chief Parker down in Los Angeles who attacked the Nation of Islam and all these people are denying that. I said, so you can't go left. I said, we got petition signs for Community Review Board. You can't go right. I said, the CAP organization can't exercise the California Supreme Court room to observe police officers carrying out the duty. Then we can't go left, we can't go right. I said, we're just like a Black Panther. This is right. And so we decided to name our organization the Black Panther Party. That October 22nd, believe it or not, that's my birthday. We flipped the coin to see who would be chairman, who would be Minister of Defense. And so that's when the party was founded. That's how the party was founded.
Members of the Black Panther Party have been following the example and the ideology and the thoughts of this man since that time and attempting to put into practice and attempting to make as many examples as possible so that all of the people will eventually ride through the streets to take their freedom with whatever means necessary, as Malcolm X used to say. And so, what they have done in the past several years since this party was begun and organized by this man, they have killed many of our brothers and sisters. They have incarcerated hundreds. They have attacked our offices. They have attacked everyone, people that we know. They have done everything they can to destroy the Black Panther Party because it wasn't any one person. They thought they could destroy one person and destroy the whole party, but they were not able to do that. And so tonight, we want to bring you for the first time since we began to celebrate the birthday of this man, the man who in October 1966 rose to the streets and declared that he was a man, and that he was a revolutionary, the Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party, and the supreme servant of the people, Yulee Bay Noonan!
I'm not here because of the Black Panther Party. I'm not here because of any group. I'm not here because of a group of kamikazes. I'm here because of the power of the people. We must remember that revolution is a process. It's not a conclusion, because once we conclude, then we become counter-revolutionary. And that means even if we conclude with a gun in our hands, because fascism also has a gun. So I would like to say tonight that the Black Panther Party stands against all forms of fascism, including sexual fascism, that we are against all kinds of chauvinism, including racial chauvinism. We're against sexual chauvinism, national chauvinism. We're intercommunal. That before I went to prison, most of you know, you're aware that I never made any speeches, you see, because I'm not a very eloquent man. I'm better known by the actions. And the party was built upon the actions. And the action itself is a process. And we're not ever fixated. We haven't accepted any dogma, and we will not. But I would like to say this, that from now on, that the party itself will be better known by its contributions to the people, for the simple reason that some people around us seem to want to be known through the media. But the party can only judge itself through establishing certain survival programs pending revolution, because remember, you make the revolution. We can't free political prisoners. Only the people can free political prisoners. And a people who are not free cannot free their prisoners. Cannot free the prisoners that fascism make. So I would like to say that we must work very hard in order to lift the consciousness of the people. We must free our chairman, Bobby Seale, Angela Davis, Rochelle McGee, the Soledad brothers, the Seven and the Three, and all other political prisoners. Randy, we have to free all of them. But we must remember that we must exhaust every possible tactic. And we must let it be known that never broadcast military tactics for military reasons. It's perfectly correct to broadcast military tactics for political reasons. That's what Uncle Ho said, and I agree with him. So we would like for the people to know that there are many things that we will not discuss in public. But what you can do is watch the fruits of GAN. And we would like to say that our party, intercommunal party,
that man feels that I don't fight, I can last my one sweet through this car, not anyone. My man.
Free the woman and also the man, that we have to get together in unity. And we cannot get together in unity by substituting verbal expressions for action. The final test of the pie is in the action. We'll stand on the Black Panther Party. Set of conditions and a particular problem that we have at a time. So please judge us upon our actions, and we will develop like that. We will not develop with lip service coming from anyone. And sometimes I'm very thankful that I don't talk too well, because that's only one way of communication. We say that a picture's worth a thousand words, but action is supreme. But what kind of action that you take will depend upon the particular set of conditions. And I say all of this because, you know, the party and the world today is under turmoil, and this is very good. We always have welcomed all forms of contradictions, because without the contradiction, there's no transformation. So from the contradiction that's developed now in the world and in the party, we hope to have a qualitative leap. And if this leap eliminates some of us, then of course we'll weep for that. But we must not stop the revolution. I will not stop the revolution. You should not stop it. And for all that is worth, that we know that words will never stop it. Words will not start the revolution either, only action. 66 kicked off the armed manifestation of revolution in this country because it focused upon the need for the people not only to defend themselves, but also to develop a consciousness necessary to perform and to act, to be able to fight in a protective war, you see? And that is why that it's necessary for us to develop the correct ideology, which is a system of thinking. And we must not rely and conclude with the philosophy, which is necessarily a conclusion. So we are ideologically revolutionists. We're in a constant state of change, and we fight with all people who want to change, because we know change will offer our hope. So after all of this, that we must pay more attention to what is happening. The news media has attempted to discredit the party by saying that it's over because they don't see anyone. I think our programs are better than the party. The communities are involved in 44 cities. We must support these. We must expand them because I read an article recently, a few months ago, where Che had some problems in Bolivia because the peasants were so unconscious until he could not rally them even with the focals. They did not understand why the military, regular military, was dropping. So what did he do? He attempted to form a certain programs that he called survival programs. He attempted to form a free health program in order to get the peasants inside to help them and also to provide things for his focals. He also attempted to form a free breakfast program and also a free shoe factory and a sporting goods store for obvious reasons. So program is good because an act that might be revolutionary could be counter-revolutionary if the correct preparations are not made. So to be a serious revolutionist, we must know that we're involved in a process and not a set of principles or conclusions that are on face value revolutionary. I do not know one thing that is revolutionary in itself, and all things might be revolutionary in its context. In other words, feudalism was revolutionary when it kicked out capitalism, and then when the feudalists were kicked out by the capitalists, that was also revolutionary. And now we have a situation where the capitalists have become the imperialists, and the people of the world or the communities of the world will have to kick him out. So in order to free Angela, Bobby, Rochelle McGee, and all other political prisoners, we must kick the fascists out, and we cannot do it with lip service. Power to the people.
Why do you think it gained so much momentum so quickly?
Actually, it didn't gain that much momentum that quickly. I'm going to tell you that. It gained momentum in terms of media coverage, probably because we took that posture of patrolling the police and standing a reasonable distance away, as the law said. We were so much in tune with the law in that process that it blew everybody's mind once the media got a hold of it. Okay, one. Like the membership still was not big. You have to remember, the membership still was not big. We never had... By the time I went to Sacramento, May 2nd, 1967, approximately 6 months later, we only had about 50, 55 members in the whole Black Panther Party. I mean, you have to imagine that, okay? Now, here we were 6 months old. Finally, I take a delegation of 24 males and 6 females, all armed. We're not carrying concealed weapons, to read a statement because Mulford, a state assemblyman from our particular area, is trying to put a bill through to stop us from carrying loaded weapons. You see what I mean? They use the phrase loaded to keep away from the Second Amendment that Malcolm X had earlier talked about. You see what I'm getting at? Now, what happens here is that we're legal in our posture. We're so legal in our posture that these guys have to pass a law to stop us from carrying loaded weapons. And the bill read out, within 150 feet of public property, and public property constituted all roadways and byways. You see the factor here? Therefore, Huey said, and we got on the media following that, and says that, well, hopefully we've given a message to the community that we will patrol the police. So whether we're walking the streets and patrolling with our guns or not, we're patrolling with our guns from our windows. You see what I mean? When they come in our community, because the police, as Huey used to say, occupy our community like a foreign troop occupies territory. So we gained that national, international notoriety like overnight in a matter of 6-7 months. That's what we had. I mean, the NAACP had been here since 1908. The Urban League had been here since World War II, 1945, what have you, before. CORE had been here since the late 50s. SCLC had been here since the mid-50s. But here was an organization now in 1966, October. By the end of May, 6 months later, 1967, the Black Panther Party had international notoriety. Front pages of the London Times and front pages of some newspapers all over Africa. In places. You see what I'm getting at?
Can you talk about, because you mentioned the Sacramento.
Yeah.
When you went up there, just tell our listeners about that, because it seems like it was very bold.
May 2nd, 1967, the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, which constituted me, Eldridge Cleaver, Huey Newton, Lil Bobby Hutton, and a couple more party members, decided to write a mandate telling people to take notice of the existence and the ability of the federal government to still open the concentration camps. And we identified some of those old concentration camps where Japanese people had been held. And further, take notice of the fact that Mulford and others in the California State Assembly and its racist posture is moving to make a law against us carrying guns in a time when racist, vicious police brutality is rampant in our communities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and black people are being murdered and killed and so on. So we voted Huey down. He could not go. I would lead the delegation. And I took 24 brothers and 6 sisters in about 6 or 7 cars. We drove up to California. We got out of our cars, guns and all, you know, with our leather jackets. Some of them was just in regular street clothes because we had to pick up some people from work. I mean, some of the party members actually went to work, and we heard about it, and so they say, okay, I'll take off work and go up there, you know, Denzel Dow Brothers, North Richmond and others. And we went there, and there we were getting out of the cars, coming up the broad walks, headed up to the Capitol steps, you know, the Capitol, the legislative.
How did that feel? I mean, here you are.
Oh, man, we were young black dudes, and we were real. We weren't jiving. I mean, Malcolm X had personified us. I mean, we're talking about 4 years from 1962 to 1966, and here was 67. We're talking about me having put in scrutiny to everything from the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa to every other demonstration, protest, and confrontation that went down in the United States during all that period. And then reading back and finding works and books like Robert Williams with Negroes with Guns, you know what I mean? And all this kind of stuff. I mean, so the whole thinking, the whole mentality, at least where I was coming from, is that we're here, I know we're legal, you know what I mean? And boom. And so Ronald Reagan is governor then of California, is out on the lawn to the right with about what he called 200 future youth. Future leaders, you know, they were all young white kids, 9, 10, 11, 12, or something like that. And so as we were coming up the walk, and remember, the press was over there with Ronald Reagan and all these kids, and as we were coming up the walk, here's 9 or 10 of these kids see us with all these guns, rifles, shotguns, etc. And so they start running towards us to see us. You know, and these little white kids says, hey, neat 30-06, hey. They thought we were a gun club or something, you know, these young white kids, you know. But the older white folks, they was looking at us, you know, and some of the media kinds, they said, you're the Black Panthers. And this is what some of the media asked me. You know, I says, yeah, we're the Black Panther Party, you know. And I have a statement I want to read. So 3 or 4 I'm going to read. So some of the white folks start dropping their mouths, man. And it's shocking to them because we was, in our polemic way, stinging the racist power circuit. So their mouths dropped open. And it was like the expressions on their face was like, oh, that's too many niggers with guns. You know what I mean? That's what was blowing their mind. And then we walked on up the stairs, and we were erroneously led inside, you know.
You mentioned that they were working on a law.
They made the law. The law, the bill came down. Mulford was a California State Assemblyman there out of the He was assembling from one of the districts right around Oakland, California there. The police had went to him to get him to make a law. We were so damn legal in our patrolling of the police for those first 6 months.
So the law went through, then you couldn't carry loaded guns.
Loaded weapons you could not carry.
The chairman of the Black Panther Party, Brother Huey's right-hand man, Bobby Seale. Bring him on. In case you never knew it or not, of all the things that you've heard in the press, of all the derogatory statements that's been made in the press about Brother Huey P. Newton and I, of all these derogatory statements to guide you away from seeing this basic platform that Huey was talking about for his own people. We have to learn to look through the white press. We have to learn to see what's going on. Let people know that it is necessary that we must unify on all levels. In all the areas of oppression, we must deal with them. That right here in the confines of racist America, racism must be stopped. We got to learn to see through what's happening out there. When we go to the court where this brother got busted, you walk up in municipal court, and I know a lot of y'all been out there. Walk up in there, you know what you see in that court? 90% black people, and the other ones who ain't black are poor white and our Mexican brothers. You catch it? You catch it? These cops are not in Piedmont brutalizing and intimidating white people. They are not in the Berkeley Hills brutalizing and intimidating white people. They are down in the black ghetto. Every time the power structure makes a political decision upon any group of people, if the people disagree with the political decision that the power structure has made upon them, then the power structure gets guns and force and billy clubs and starts doubling and tripling police force and National Guard to make you accept those political decisions it's made when you try to disagree.
Okay, you also had some confrontations with the police, which seemed maybe you can just explain the feeling of those when some of the Panthers, I think there was a situation where you were the security for Malcolm's wife, Betty Shabazz.
Well, we prefer, that was a situation where we went over to escort Sister Betty Shabazz from the airport because we had a big event in San Francisco, and we just told the police we were going in. They told them we couldn't go in, and Huey said that this airport, it accommodates over 200 people anywhere, or any location or institutional framework that accommodates over 200 people. I have a right to exercise my constitutional rights. The guns are none of your business. They're part of the Second Amendment of the Constitution. They're not concealed and not illegal. Huey told me to line up everybody. He said, forward march, and marched in. So the police just followed and looked at us while we went inside to the gate and picked up Sister Betty Shabazz and brought her out. And later, I mean, that was over in Ramparts Magazine. We had a big standoff over there because these ignorant cops, you know, they got the bunching all up, talking about don't touch your gun. I told them don't touch yours. And Huey said, spread these back shooting. Spread, don't turn your back on these back shooting MFs. And we spread it and backed up the street. I mean, it was like a standoff, you know what I mean? And Betty Shabazz was in a car and gone at the time. You know, it was in front of Ramparts where Eldridge Cleaver worked. But at this time, Eldridge Cleaver was not a member of the Black Panther Party. What people have to understand, Eldridge Cleaver joined the Black Panther Party 6 months later, after Huey and I created it. So me, you know, and I'm not a racist, you know. I don't hate, you know, but I hear some black folks say, you might as well be a racist, they racist. That is falling in the same pit they fall in, you know what I mean? I believe in cooperational humanism, you know what I mean? And I mean a people's revolutionary cooperational humanism where you revolve more cooperational humanism in political, economic, and social institutions, where you evolve better human relationships between people on the face of this earth. That's what I believe in. I've been believing in that all through that era of the Black Panther Party. I understood who to criticize. That's why Huey and I said all power to all the people. We didn't just reside on the rhetoric and phraseology of only black power, because we understood the class relation and the class analysis of what was going down, and what we began to understand and perceive in a worldwide sense let alone understanding the necessity of organizing concretely and directly and specifically in our black community areas, and then allowing for good working coalitions with the sincere left-white radicals, the anti-war, and others of those who'd work with the civil rights movement, who then begin to swing to our side after more profoundly after Bobby Kennedy was killed.